You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producers Liam and Flo. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For Dear Science this week, our expert Dr. Kushla McGovern speaks with us about poison frogs, songbirds generating neurons and personalised brain sensors. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with Ryan Hamilton about New Zealand's fuel stocks and how the government is moving forwards with regards to fuel and positioning around the Strait of Hormuz. Flo, what have you got for us today?
Kia ora, Alex. I spoke with Associate Professor Andrew Eruiti at the University of Auckland's Law School about the government's proposed changes to treaty obligations.
And Liam, what do you have for us today?
I spoke with Steve Bielby, Director of the St. James Theatre, about the rebuild of the historic St. James Theatre, what challenges and opportunities it has brought, and what this will mean for Auckland and its heritage.
Hey, ahaf o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch to kupatohi mai, text in on 5395 or waiamai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware e āhei ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero āno, hei pākehere roki roki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia te mata te whakaturanga, let's get on to the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we're joined by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern.
Kia ora.
Thanks for being here. What have we got in the world of science today?
Some really cool stories. Poison frogs.
Love them.
Neurons not really acting like we expected in songbirds. And yes, some personalised medicine for maybe the future, not today, but some pretty cool advances there.
Hey, an advancement in medicine is always exciting.
Yeah. So we'll start off with poisonous frogs.
I love poisonous frogs. What have we got?
So yeah, basically, if you're ever walking around in the forest of Central and Southern America and you see this beautiful, tiny but really beautiful frog that's either red or bright green or bright blue and that sort of thing, don't pick it up. It's likely to be poisoned. And how they basically release these toxic chemicals through their skin. So it's an evolved mechanism of fending off predators and such. Mm. Now, these toxins belong to a family of chemicals called alkaloids. And how these frogs are able to do this is they actually, it's derived from their diet. So they have to eat ants, mites, millipedes, beetles to basically absorb these compounds and then store them. So this process is called sequestration. And they can also actually modify the alkaloids once they have ingested them to make them more toxic. And so this study was really about kind of investigating more about how did this evolve? Was it gradual over time or was there suddenly these frogs that could do this and they bred and so they evolved to have this trait? Because if you think about the evolutionary path that it took these frogs to do this, they needed to first develop a resistance to the toxin, right? If you go eat the ants and the millipedes and they kill you, it's not survival of the fittest. Then you also need to develop a mechanism to transport those toxins from your digestive tract to your skin without actually metabolizing it, so without making it like detoxifying it kind of thing. And so there'd been two recent findings around these frogs, where closely related groups of frogs, which we previously thought couldn't actually sequester these alkaloids, they actually did have low levels in their skin, so they had some capacity to do this. And then they also found that with these poisonous frogs, they actually were modifying the alkaloids much more than they thought. Like they were, there was a vast array of these different types of alkaloids, like a wider range than they actually thought. And so this is kind of pointing towards this idea that it's gradual, and that's kind of what you would maybe instinctively think, that it's a gradual process. But they wanted to do some experiments and just investigate this a bit more. So if you imagine frogs in the forest or in the, you know, out in the wild, they're going to be pretty hard to observe over time, particularly when you're wanting to see how much they eat and what they're eating and this sort of thing. So they did what was sensible in this case, and they went to the lab. They collected some frogs to do the experiments in the lab where they could really control their diet. So they had several different species of these poisonous frogs, and then they had a close relative species and then a distant relative species. I would love to know what the health and safety is around trying to do these experiments. Like, what sort of gloves are you wearing to not make yourself sick over time?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what they did was they basically had two experiments where they were feeding different alkaloids to see how the frogs handled it in different amounts of it. So in the first experiment, they would use basically little droppers to feed them. So they could really precisely know how much they had given the frogs, how much the frogs had ingested. And in the second experiment, they basically sprinkled some powder onto their food, which was fruit flies, because that's more akin to what you'd see in the wild, right, than the eating that in. And then basically they tested the skin and the organs of the frogs afterwards to see what type of alkaloids were there and how much. And what they found was it was actually from being not poisonous at all to a little bit toxic to kind of medium levels to high, there was a continuum in how much they actually expressed the alkaloids on their skin. And that they also found that there was, again, that this modification process was really unique to the ones that were sequestering well and stuff. And so it's basically further evidence for the fact that this was a gradual change, that small steps needed to happen in this evolutionary process to get to this point. And obviously, as all good science goes, the more questions. So now they want to basically look at what are the molecular sort of paths that are occurring within the frogs that basically take in these alkaloids and modify it and store it. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
See, going into this, I had no idea that poison frogs had to eat things.
Yeah, it's totally there. If they had a alkaloid-free diet, they wouldn't be so poisonous.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And plus with the evolving to then have the colour as well, to be like, hey, I've eaten this.
Yeah, no, it's really, you know, as soon as you see nice brightly coloured animals in the wild, don't touch them. Stay clear. It really is the warning system, hey.
Yeah.
Admittedly, there are some animals that have evolved to have those colours to mimic other things that are poisonous now, but if in doubt,
it's a beautiful world.
Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of the beautiful world, what do we have next?
So the next one is about zebrafinch, which are these really cute little birds that are native to Australia. And they're songbirds. And they're really well known for their ability to pick up new songs. Like, they're fast learners. And so they've actually been used a lot in animal studies now to study the brain and how it imprints new skills or its capacity to learn new sounds. So they're kind of a nice study animal. And what this study has done is they've basically studied their brains in like really fine detail. So they've used these techniques of electron microscopy, which gives you very high resolution images, to basically study the brain cells, so the neurons, particularly in reference to this process called neurogenesis. So neurogenesis is just a description of how neurons are birthed, migrate, and mature. And so in humans, when we're born, we have about as many neurons as we ever are going to have. Like, through life, we actually lose some. And this is a, mammals are all like this, basically. But reptiles and birds can actually grow new neurons during their life. And so this neurogenesis process, if you can grow these new neurons, maybe this is actually good for preventing against neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and stuff. Like, that maybe is why humans are prone to getting those sort of things, because we can't repair. Because one of the descriptions I saw was like, basically, we're operating with a brain that's version 1.0. You know, it does those cells never replace. Whereas our other organs, the cells replace and stuff. And so what they're interested in, these zebra finches, is this process of neurodegeneration neurodegenerative. Oh, yeah, that word.
Yeah.
Basically, and so what they, the hypothesis or what they thought would happen is as these new neurons form, and they're basically forming connections to other neurons, so you build up these networks and that's how information gets processed and stuff, that they would take kind of a polite path. You know, they would move around the things that are already there, these brain structures, because you don't want to damage them, right? Because, you know, they're there for a purpose. You've got communication of these other neurons. That's not what they saw. The new neurons were just like blasting through. They called it cell tunneling. They were basically squishing and shoving everything out of the way to form these new paths. And they were like, oh, that was a surprise.
Doesn't sound particularly pleasant.
No, exactly, right? And so while this maybe helps these zebrafinch learn new things very quickly, because, and that's why they can pick up these new songs, maybe there is actually a cost that you lose memories or existing knowledge because these cells get damaged. And so they obviously don't know that yet. Like, they've just observed that this process happens in a way we didn't expect. But out of this study, they now have two hypotheses that are untested and they've just put out there for groups to now consider, where maybe in humans, we don't have a lot of this neurogenesis where we make these new neurons because it's actually protecting our memories. Like, it's a protection mechanism for our brain. So we just strengthen connections rather than forming completely new cells to form completely new connections. But the other thing that's perhaps more exciting in some ways is that with this tunneling they observed of these neurons that they just kind of blasted through wherever they wanted, they weren't following what were called glial scaffolds. So glial scaffolds are basically structures in the brain that are like the highway for these cells to travel along. And so when we're in the womb and our brain's developing, there's a lot of these glial scaffolds. But as soon as we're born, we kind of basically lose them. And so this has been one of the challenges of neurogenesis in adult brains to, you know, if we're looking at trying to develop methods to reverse Alzheimer's and such, because we're like, well, what are we going to do? We don't have these glial scaffolds, so how can we form new neurons that form the right connections? And this study is basically showing that maybe we don't need to. So these stem cell therapies and stuff that people are looking at, maybe this is something they should be looking at and considering more. And so, yeah, I think it'll be watch this space sort of thing.
Hell yeah. Love. It's such a, always so fun when you find out that just like some bird has, you know, an untold potential, I guess.
Yeah, right. Like, and that's that. Observing this animal behavior that is doing something that where you're like, it's kind of quite phenomenal that they can like learn new sounds or learn new songs really quickly, and that, and then how does that actually happen, and then how can it actually relate to us and improve medicine? Like, who links zebrafinch brains with human brains in terms of developing therapies for neurodegenerative diseases?
But hey, we got here with it, so
yeah,
awesome.
Yeah.
And I mean, another great link, brains.
Yes, so we're sticking to the brain. And this article is just about a group that's perhaps come up with a new way of making neural interfaces. And so neural interfaces are basically these tiny sensors that you put on the brain to track biophysical chemical signals. So yeah, it's basically sensing signals in the brain. You use it. They get used to monitor and in some cases treat neurodegenerative diseases. But currently they're made in a way that's one size fits all. So they're quite stiff. You basically, it fits or it doesn't kind of thing. They make it work. But you can imagine that brains are quite complex.
Yeah, not exactly a one size.
Exactly, right. They're each quite unique. So if you think about any sort of picture you've seen in the brain and it's got all those folds and stuff. So the major folds tend to be reasonably common across everyone or all humans, but the small folds that you get are quite unique. So, you know, like we often use the analogy of a fingerprint being unique to each individual. The folds of your brain are the same. And we basically have those folds in our brain because it allows cells to communicate at higher speeds because cells get put closer together and such. And one thing that I was really surprised by, if you take the outer layer of your brain and you stretch it out so it's not all folded up and stuff, it's 2,000 square centimetres.
Oh.
That's a lot of surface area in your head. So needless to say, one size fit all fits all's kind of not really great. So this study was like, how can we make this better? So they took MRIs of 21 different people's brains and generated just digital three-dimensional models, and then used those to basically shape these neural interfaces to sit on the brain a lot better. And then they've printed both. So printed the brain just to have a structure that they could test on, and then they printed these electrodes or these neural interfaces, actually using these hydrodels that can conduct electrical signals. What was also really cool, though, is, well, the hydrogel is soft, so it's kind of more similar to the brain than what are a lot of the things we have now, which are quite stiff and hard. So it's not going to damage the brain tissue quite as much. They also use like a honeycomb structure to print the electrodes, or these neural interfaces, because if you think about a honeycomb, it's quite strong, but it's quite flexible as well. And it also means you don't use as much material, so you kind of reduce the cost of it. And so then they tested it against their 3D printed stuff, and it, yeah, they fitted more precisely, as you might imagine. But of course, they printed it in the lab. Is this really that interesting? So then they went to the lab rats and implanted, they did the similar thing, right? And then they implanted their neural interface, left it for 28 days, and then basically they wanted to observe, was there any performance degradation over that time? And there wasn't really, so that's good. But they also needed to check that there's no inflammatory response, right? Because as soon as you put something into the body, your immune system goes, what's this?
And get
your
immune out.
Yeah, exactly, right? And they actually found that there wasn't so bad. There was maybe a little bit, but it wasn't bad with these because you are using those hydrogels and those biocompatible substances and stuff. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, the man, the human brain.
Yeah.
It is an amazing thing, but yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kushla, for joining us. Thank you, MOTAT, and thank you, Science. Aviation Conversations at MOTAT. Enjoy an evening in the Aviation Hall with a panel discussing exploring aerial mapping technology. 30th of April, book now at motat.nz.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Armageddon! It's the most exciting gaming and pop culture event of the year. And if you are a wielder of the all-powerful B card, then you could win tickets. So stay tuned to 95BFM Breakfast all week for your cue to enter. Armageddon, Anzac Long Weekend, April 25th till the 27th at the Auckland Showgrounds. Get your tickets now at iticket.co.nz or on the door.
Here comes the box with a musical star, with 1,000 tons of bird shot.
That's to me, one and only,
Crisp biscuits and fresh vegetables every Tuesday from 7 p.m. Replayed 4 a.m. Wednesday and always online at 95bfm.com. Check it.
Stinky Jim. Stinks from within.
I believe in like the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Auraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Thank you.
That was Do You Realize by The Flaming Lips. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, fuel stocks in the country went down by 3 or 4 days across each fuel type. The government recognised this, however, as not enough to change to Phase 2 in the National Fuel Plan, drawing some concerned comments from the political opposition around the state of our stocks and when the government plans to actually move up phases. Following a week that saw both Finance Minister Nicola Willis and Prime Minister Christopher Luxon comment on the state of the Strait of Hormuz and the way the United States has handled the ongoing conflict, Willis also travelled to the US to meet with White House advisers. This week, I spoke with National MP Ryan Hamilton about these fuel crisis developments and what the government's approach going forward may look like. To start our discussion, however, we spoke briefly about the confidence in Christopher Luxon's leadership. Just to get us started, I would like to briefly touch on this weekend's chatter about Christopher Luxon's leadership. The National Party caucus is meeting today to discuss kind of the situation. Is the National Party still confident in Christopher Luxon as the Prime Minister?
Yeah, 100%. He's the right man for the job.
And looking outside of necessarily where the National Party stands on Christopher Luxon as the right man for the job, is there a sort of sense of tension or pressure within the party, not looking at him specifically, but kind of how the public has been reacting to his leadership?
Oh, I think there's always mixed views with leadership, but you know, we're just focused on good policy execution, obviously leading up to the election, and then and campaigning again to ensure that we get another 3-year term So we're really focused on that. And the only poll that really matters is November 7.
Moving on, last week also saw discussion around the government's national fuel plan. Fuel stocks dropped last week by about 3 to 4 days across each type. What's the government's current stance on the state of fuel stocks in the country?
Well, as you know, we've got that fourth phase response, and we're still in that first phase, or phase four. So I think it's phase four, if I've got that written the wrong way. So, you know, we're confident that we're still, there's going to be some ebbs and flows with shipping and transit and that sort of thing. But we're comfortable that we're still within that band as per expectations.
And when it comes to that band, what sort of lines are we seeing being drawn by the government in terms of when are we going to be moving into these new phases?
Well, we hope that we wouldn't. I mean, I guess that's the first thing. You know, the first two phases are really about just ensuring that we continue to maintain supply. And that's where our focus has been. Obviously, the Prime Minister and the leadership team involved have been very proactive in terms of, you know, relationships with Australia, Singapore and Korea in terms of resilience and ensuring we've got supply arrangements with other partners. And Singapore is quite a key relationship because we've already got free trade agreements with them. And, I mean, that's really where the focus is, you know. And if we get into those other phases, then obviously we look at starting to restrict use selectively. But we hope we don't come to that.
I mean, you've touched on it there, but what sort of agreements are we seeing from the government in terms of kind of securing more fuel stocks for the country?
Well, with Singapore, we've got a free trade agreement, and often in free trade agreements, the country is allowed to protect its own emergency supplies over and above whatever free trade agreement is in existence. But with Singapore, they've worked on a bit of a carve-out where Singapore is dependent on imported food for them, exported from us, and likewise we're dependent on imported fuel. And so we've reached an agreement with them where we can supply them food and they can supply us fuel, which is quite a specific carve-out within the free trade agreement that our leadership teams worked through, led by the Prime Minister through his relationships with Singapore. So that's a good example of more optionality should we need it, because essentially we need to collaborate. We're all, you know, well, certainly we're an island nation. Singapore is landlocked and has the need for some of the endowments which we have, obviously our ability to produce food and fibre. So that's a really good example that we've got in place should we need to action that.
Comments have been made, however, about the kind of, when we look at these fuel stocks going down, especially Labor has sort of faced National with this criticism about when exactly these stocks going down equates to a shortage. What sort of framework do the National Party and the government have in place for kind of where this line between stocks down and a shortage is?
I don't have that right in front of me, but there are thresholds that they'll use, and that would, you know, put them into the next band, which is quite clear in terms of what the next line of actions would be. But for now, there's comfort in the current state of play. The most important thing, obviously, that we've been quite clear to make is, you know, our targeted timely response. And you've seen some of that. We've talked about some of that in the last few weeks with the in-tax family credit, obviously the disability travel allowance, and then just this week, you know, support for those in rural areas, isolated teachers and parents. We've lifted the travel rate for them so they can get a little bit more support up to a year, or until the price of 91 changes or drops below $3 per litre for 4 consecutive weeks. So we're sort of looking, it's a live issue, and we're looking each week at who's the most affected, how can we help? Because obviously we don't want, you know, we've campaigned on education, high attendance and those sorts of things. So we're making sure that children, for example, aren't, you know, victim to a fuel crisis where they can't go to school and learn. So those, you can continually see the, you know, the targeted response we're making to those people that are most affected, and just trying to alleviate, you know, those cost pressures but in a way that doesn't, it's not broad brush, so they're not just spraying money around everywhere, and those that can absorb the costs are getting the benefit. We're really targeting those who can feel it the most.
I mean, yeah, just on that, are there any sorts of communities or groups like this that the government is currently kind of looking at getting into with this support, this targeted support, or is it kind of just really a week-by-week basis?
Well, I think as cost pressures continue, those that are struggling, they will start to come to the surface in terms of, you know, frustration or anxiety or pressure. And so we are looking at across the spectrum. I mean, there's a lot of first and second and third order implications. Obviously, it's not just the price of fuel at the pump, but it's the flow-on effect to, you know, to tradies, to customers purchasing goods and services, to, you know, impact on the economy through tourism and eating out and those sorts of things. So, you know, there's a whole work stream going on. I think, you know, the transport industry is obviously hugely affected. So we're looking at, are there any levers that we can use? Maybe they're financial, maybe it's legislative, that would give them more scope or more capacity within the existing framework. So, yeah, there's a lot of work going on, but I think we have to be iterative because, A, we don't know how long this is going to last, and or B, we can't foresee all of the impacts immediately and how they play out. So I think we've just got to be nimble, but we are really trying to take our learnings from that COVID era where, you know, $30 billion was effectively sprayed out and drove up, you know, inflation, the cost of living, and the impact obviously is felt, you know, 3, 4, 5 years later. And so we're really trying to learn those lessons from Treasury and you know, work within the buffers that we've got.
And just finally, the government has obviously spoken to the necessity of reopening the Strait of Hormuz. Nicola Willis, in particular, has now travelled to kind of discuss a lot of the implications of this ongoing fuel crisis. But going forward, what can we kind of expect to see with regards to how New Zealand approaches the parties involved with the hostilities to kind of look forward to resolving this conflict?
Yeah, well, obviously, we saw Nicola was in Washington last week, and as a party, we'll be catching up today, and we hope to hear from her on that and what her thoughts and ideas are around that. And the Prime Minister said, you know, he's already signed international agreements to try and keep the Strait of Hormuz open, and potentially, you know, even considering whether there needs a stronger response from a New Zealand defence perspective. So I think all options are open, and it's pretty iterative. But certainly today, post our caucus, we should know a little bit more in terms of next steps.
That was National Party MP Ryan Hamilton on Luxon's leadership, fuel stocks and the wider fuel situation.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
After an NZ First initiative from within the coalition agreement, the government has proposed to weaken treaty obligations. Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith claimed the government was attempting to create more consistency by changing the semantics of obligations to make the government take the treaty into account rather than previous formulations such as honour the treaty or have regard for the treaty. Critics have said the changes attempt to weaken obligation to the Treaty of Waitangi and have opened grey zones based on semantic understandings. I spoke with Associate Professor Andrew Eduiti at the University of Auckland's Law School about the government's proposed changes to treaty obligations.
Yeah, so I'm Andrew Eduiti, and I'm an Associate Professor at the Law School.
So what are the extent of the changes being made to treaty obligations?
So the proposal is to amend, there are about 20 different pieces of legislation that are the subject of this review, and the proposal is to amend all of the references to the treaty principles across the suite of statutes so that they simply require that any decision makers under the Act take into account the Treaty of Waitangi.
There's a bit of a semantic question in there. Do you believe that this taking into account that will be used and utilised to circumvent obligations and to possibly ignore them?
Yeah, I do think it does have the effect of diminishing treaty rights. Some of these statutes actually already use that language, but there are others that use other phrases. Like you say, it's a question of semantics. Phrases like giving effect, act consistently with, or have regard to, or recognize and provide for, these are the typical types of phrases used in these treaty principles clauses, but take into account is widely considered to be at the lower end of the threshold. And it's received a lot of criticism, particularly from the Waitangi Tribunal, because when it's used in legislation, it suggests to decision makers that you can turn your mind to the principles of the treaty, but it's one factor among many other competing factors to consider, and often it's overridden by other factors.
The Justice Minister, Paul Goldsmith, had said that these updates aim to achieve more consistency. And I guess, as you'd mentioned, there are usually quite a few factors involved in these decisions. And, well, as far as I understand, there is a bit of a case-by-case basis of adhering to treaty principles. This apparent attempt at consistency kind of contradict dominant forms of treaty obligations that we've used in the past.
Yeah, the Minister has said that what he's just supporting is a treaty clause that requires a balance of considerations to be taken into account. But, you know, like I mentioned, that often the treaty principles are trumped by other considerations like commercial interests. And in some cases, and it is case by case, but in some cases there will be a need for treaty interests to be given a high priority. You know, that won't be for all cases where there are a range of competing interests. But in some cases, there's legislation that has a particular impact or has. It's necessary to have statutory measures to lift, say, the education outcomes for Māori in the Education Act. There's a strong case to be made for greater weighting to be provided to the treaty in those sorts of contexts. So just adopting a one standardised approach, but also the lowest possible weighting that you can use, is a productive approach towards the treaty principles.
The current government have often emphasised cutting red tape. This could potentially be seen as part of that as well. I guess in this case, the question is this so-called red tape that is being cut quite an essential part of our democratic and constitutional process?
There's a lot of time and energy invested in this treaty review process, and I'm not saying that it's a bad idea to review legislation to make sure it's fit for purpose. And the minister set up an advisory group, and one of the things they said is that these clauses, they could be made more consistent, right? There could be greater clarity. And I think that is true. But the reason for this review is because of the coalition agreement between the current administration. And really the raison d'etre was really about confining and limiting treaty rights. Sure, endorse the idea of reviewing legislation to make sure that it meets the objectives and policy in each statute, but the way in which the politicians have gone about this, it has attracted a great deal of criticism from Māori who are concerned about the impacts on treaty settlements and concerned about this adulteration of the obligations and really important statutes like the Education Act. It has kind of reinforced stereotypes and negative perceptions of Māori. So one has to wonder whether this process was actually necessary. One good thing I think it has revealed, and this is from the expert advisory group, is that there is some utility in moving beyond these kind of generic treaty clauses, you know, give effect to the treaty and so forth, and actually specify in more detail what the relevant obligations should be in legislation. And New Zealand was actually moving towards that pattern and producing more statutes that contain these more specified treaty obligations and spelling them out. And I think that is the way to go in the future, is to be very clear about what the obligations are. But at the same time, that requires placing great faith in the government to ensure this is identified all the treaty interests, and that requires close engagement with Māori and a lot of research and consideration. So I think that's the best way to go forward from here, rather than falling back on this generic treaty clause, which has a very low weighting for treaty interests.
So yeah, I guess that would, in a different form, also lead to more consistency in applying a lot of the treaty obligations if there were kind of more specific frameworks to apply them. But that would obviously be engaging a lot more directly with the principles and also honouring and rather than reducing their effects, which I'm guessing is what is kind of happening now.
It's definitely a reductive approach towards treaty obligations, and I think that is right, that more thorough thinking about, you know, what are the policy objectives of the Health and Disability Act or the Education Act, what are the relevant treaty interests, how can we meet those, spelling those out clearly in the legislation. It means there's less uncertainty and less need for litigation to clarify the scope of right. Expert advisory group appointed by the minister made this recommendation as well. Rather than relying on the treaty clause, this generic low wattage version of the treaty clause, more work done on identifying treaty interests, I think, is necessary.
That was Andrew Edoiti speaking about the reduction of treaty obligations by the government.
That was April Skies by the Jesus and Mary Chain. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
And as soon as they saw me, they came bounding over.
The St. James Theatre, which first opened in 1928, is a Category 1 heritage building sitting on Queen Street in Auckland's Arts Precinct. Once a venue for many shows and concerts, and having hosted notable individuals including Queen Elizabeth II, it has since been in a state of disrepair after it closed following a fire in 2007. Its fate has long been debated, as it further decayed, and attempts to restore it had stalled due to lack of funding. Finally, in 2023, the government announced it would match Auckland Council's pledge of $15 million for the rebuild, allowing work to fully recommence. I spoke to Steve Bielby, director of the St. James Holdings, about how the rebuild is coming along now that funding is secure, what remains to be done, and how the public is engaging with the news that the St. James will one day reopen its doors. So last time you spoke on BFM, the state of the St. James was pretty dire, with thefts, leaky roofs, and funding uncertainty. What is the future looking like now? Are all the pieces of the puzzle coming together, or are there still major challenges remaining?
No, I think we've got the major pieces of the puzzle in place for the theatre now. So construction started, consents have gone in and things like that. So no, physical works have started on site and we're into it. You know, we've now got a target of opening at some point in 2028. Looking forward to getting the public and welcoming the public back into it.
Are there any major challenges remaining?
Look, other than the fact that it's a 100-year-old building and we're trying to structurally upgrade it and we've got to make it fit for purpose for modern productions, you know, theatres are already a pretty complicated building, but to try build a modern theatre inside an old theatre, you know, certainly presents challenges, requires pretty bespoke solutions. So we're working through them, and I think we're starting to solve some of those sort of unknowns.
Yeah. Yeah, in terms of those bespoke solutions, how big is this enterprise and how are you obtaining the expertise and material to undertake the project?
I guess there's two elements. There's the structural upgrade and services upgrade of the building, which essentially is, making the building fit for purpose and with things like, new modern fire sprinkler systems and all that compliance stuff that we're required to do. And then there's the ornate sort of fine arts restoration of the heritage building. The ornate fine art stuff is a lot more nuanced and a lot more niche, and the new, more compliant stuff is really just about being solutions focused and trying to find ways that work that we can do things. You don't really have a lot of choice. It's compliance stuff, so you have to do it. It's just about how we do it.
And one of the recent developments was the second venue underneath the St. James. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so essentially the St. James has always had a northern basement and a southern basement, and the auditorium was in between those two. So what we had to do for a fire compliance point of view was link those two basements together. So if there was a fire in one, you could exit through the other one rather than be trapped down there. And what we found when we sort of priced that bit of work, which essentially was building a tunnel between the two, it was actually more cost effective for us just to remove the material completely and not have a tunnel at all, just sort of create like a giant open space. So that's exactly what we've done. And then we sort of thought, well, this is a really large space. And, there's a bit of a shortage in the city of available sort of performing arts spaces and things like rehearsal spaces and things like that. So we decided that we'd turn it into a bit of a black box venue. So it's not part of our scope to fit it out or, all the finishes or anything like that. But we will build the shell and essentially the black box side of it. So it's sort of a bit of a blank canvas for people to come in and be able to use.
Will it be built in a similar style to the rest of the St. James, or will it be completely different?
No, so it won't be. The St. James is a Spanish Baroque building that was built 100 years ago, so we'll leave the main auditorium and the main St. James building in that style, and that will be restored, whereas the black box venue in the basement will be of today, so it will be a modern level, modern toilets and, things like that in it. So it will be, fit for purpose and not sort of a replica or trying to replicate another look.
What are the plans for the long-term maintenance of the St. James once restoration is complete? Where will funding come from and who will operate it?
Yeah, so that's part of the operating model, which we're about to go out to the public in the next couple of months and consult on and ask the public, what do you want to see in there and how do you want to see the venue operated? And that will inform, those more longer-term decisions. I like the idea of kind of like a heritage venue levy. You know, there's 50 cents or something for every ticket sold there that goes into a maintenance sinking fund for the building. And that sort of, you know, after the roof, you might need replacing after 25 years, you know, suddenly you've got a fund there to be able to do that or to fund, you know, parts of it at least. So that's sort of my view, but we're going to go out to the public and ask the public what they want, how they want to see it operated, and that will really dictate how that, you know, the answers to those questions.
Right, so you expect the building to sort of fund itself over time?
Well, I think there's an option there where it does fund itself, and that that will appeal to some people. It won't appeal to others. You know, I guess there's a wide range of views about how the theatre should operate, you know, whether it should be like a charitable community-run model, whether it should be run as part of the like the Auckland Live, Te Takahi Auckland Unlimited model that run the council venues. So they run the Aotea Centre and the Civic across the road and the Town Hall. Or, you know, is it commercially run? Is it run as a commercial venue? You know, such as the power station and venues like that. So there's sort of a wide range of options there, and each one sort of has its, you know, pros and cons, and I think it's sort of about assessing what the public want and then building the business case and scopes around each of those and what they cost and the viability for each one. So that's sort of our next package of work.
And coming out of COVID and with the cost of living crisis and potentially competition from other venues like the Civic, do you expect there will be sufficient demand for the venue?
Oh, yeah. The Civic, actually, people struggle to get dates in the Civic. So we're not anticipating any issues with a lack of demand or anything like that. You know, we've done our business case based on the St. James Sister Theatre over in Melbourne called the Palais, and that has in excess of 220 event nights booked there a year. So there's definitely the content out there to bring there, whether... you know, I don't think that content's currently coming, or some of that content's not currently coming to New Zealand. So it would bring new content here, which is, I think, something to be excited about.
So we would get more shows and it would sort of support the entertainment industry?
Yeah, and I think it supports Midtown as a precinct. You know, that whole arts quarter, you know, that's where we're trying to create a hub and a centre of excellence around. And it's just another sort of string in the bow of Midtown. You know, I don't see the Civic and the Town Hall as competition. I think they're all actually quite unique venues and in their own space. You know, for example, the Civic is really set up to do its amazing large-scale musicals and productions like that, whereas the St. James might have a different focus. You know, it might be more concerts and comedy, the smaller-style productions, more smaller-size productions.
You have campaigned a lot to politicians and to obtain funding, but at the same time, you've fostered a strong social media presence. What is the importance of this online presence and how much engagement are you receiving?
I think it's just part of the modern project ecosystem, really. It's all about, you know, taking people on the journey with you, especially in these sort of these public type projects, which is essentially what this is. I think, you know, people have an interesting project and people want to know about it. So making that information available to them and presenting it in a way that is, you know, digestible to the current generation, which is things like social media, is a really important part of the story to tell.
Yeah. How are people responding to this whole project in general?
Are they fanatics about it? People love it. Yeah. I think in this sort of crazy twilight world that we're living in at the moment, people are pretty amped for good news and a good news story. And that's what this project is. This is an ambitious project which says, look, this is going to be better in the future. And I think that's what people are looking for at the moment.
Yeah. I was fortunate enough to do a tour of the St. James last year, just before the restoration commenced. And walking through it, the building was obviously dilapidated, but like you could feel like the history and the sense of future potential.
Yeah, look, it's amazing how much the building needing a good clean and just fixing some of those things that are like the deferred maintenance issues. You know, like it's really had deferred maintenance for the last 30 to 40 years. And I think that, you know, addressing some of those issues really, you know, we're just even getting some of the lighting going in there at the moment. And that's such a huge difference, you know, some of the architectural lighting.
Yeah. But I mean, could I ask you, like, what does the St. James make you feel being in there? And has that changed over time?
I think I've been on a bit of a unique journey with St. James where it's sort of had a lot of ups and downs. For me, I think I'll be able to relax a lot more once it's finished. I think once it's done. For me, it sort of still represents a lot of work and a lot of things that we're still trying to solve, you know, some of those sticky issues. You know, we're now sort of dealing with really small-scale micro decisions sort of thing, you know, like, oh, which way do we run this cable or which way do we run that cable? You know, what's the best route to take? But they're still decisions that have to be made, you know, every day.
What brought you to this project originally?
Look, I have a, I run a trust that restores historic buildings, and this is, I guess, the top of the pyramid. This is the ultimate heritage restoration project in New Zealand. You don't get much bigger than this, and more challenging than this. And I think I was attracted to the challenge. Also, it's an important building to me. Like, when I went to university, we didn't have a Spark Arena or anything like that for concerts. So it was St. James. You know, you had artists, you know, large artists like Kanye West and John Legend and the Black Eyed Peas. You know, they played St. James because that was where artists played. So for me, it was quite a, I guess, quite a part of those seminal years of my life. And as a part of me, it's a bit sad that it's not there for, you know, the generation going through right now.
Yeah, yeah. And what can we learn from the St. James about protecting our heritage buildings in New Zealand?
I think, you know, just the public response to St. James tells us that people do care about it. You know, we do have a culture, we do have a history, and it is worth protecting and enhancing if we can. You know, it has got value and we should value it.
Yeah, I guess last question, can we expect a 2028 opening at this stage?
Yeah, look, that's what we're targeting at the moment, and that's what our program shows. And I think we'll get a real clear picture on that in the next 12 months.
That was Steve Bielby speaking about the ongoing rebuild of the St. James Theatre, which is expected to open in 2028.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ke maua mō tēnei rā.
That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you everyone who spoke to us today. Dr. Kushla McGovern, National MP Ryan Hamilton, Andrew Eruiti of the University of Auckland Law School, and Steve Bielby of St. James Holdings. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You are listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.